ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, inflation's falling, but can we expect an interest rate cut anytime soon? The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, is my guest. Also, farmers racing to get their livestock to higher ground as the rain keeps on falling in Queensland, and Australia warned not to restore funding to the UN Relief Agency for Palestinian refugees after allegations its employees have Hamas links.
UNRWA says you're a refugee forever to the Palestinians, and the war of 1948 is not over, and the world is with you. So that was the message of UNRWA, and it blew up in our faces on October 7th.
First to the economy, and it may not feel like it, but there is more positive news on inflation. It's come down again and fast. Official figures show in the 3 months to December, inflation came in at 4.1%. That's well down from 5.4% in the previous quarter and lower than markets were expecting. But it's still above where the Reserve Bank wants to see it, at between 2 and 3%, because the cost of rent, energy bills and insurance premiums continues to climb. Is it enough of a fall, though, to warrant Reserve Bank interest rate cuts later this year? The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, joins the program shortly. But first, here's David Taylor.
Inflation peaked in Australia in December 2022 at 7.8%. The latest official annual inflation check now has it at 4.1%, which is a two-year low.
There is a very clear downward trend in inflation in Australia.
AMP's Deputy Chief Economist Diana Musina is also encouraged by the quarterly inflation figure of just 0.6%.
So if you do a quarterly annualised number on the trimmed mean, it's actually running at 3.1%. That's pretty much the top end of the target.
What you're saying is if you take the price rises just in the quarter and you stretch that out over a year, the number's pretty good.
That's right, exactly.
The biggest inflationary drops this quarter were for household goods, transport and education. But there were significant price rises for tobacco, up 7%, property prices, up 1.5%, and domestic holiday travel and accommodation, up 3.9%. The prices of food and drink also rose by 0.5 percentage point in the 3 months to December, a slightly smaller increase than we saw in the September quarter. But it's the prices of services in the economy, think renting, gas and electricity services, as well as insurance, that's still costing us an arm and a leg. The chief economist of investment firm Jardine, Carlos Cacho, says the Reserve Bank will be concerned that services inflation remains, as the ABS puts it, high.
A lot of that pressure on services is coming through areas that the RBA doesn't have that much of an impact on, things like insurance premiums, which are rising at the fastest pace in years at over 16%.
AMP's Diana Musina is more optimistic that the cost of services in the economy will fall this year.
If you're looking at forward-looking signs on new asking rents, they're looking better. Electricity, gas prices also look like they're going to come down this year based on forward contracts.
Which could prompt the RBA, she says, to ease the burden on households paying off a mortgage by cutting interest rates by July.
We think that they're going to start easing by the middle of this year.
So that's what the economists think. But what do you say about the cost of living? Is it getting any better? Well, these people across the Nullarbor in Perth aren't so sure.
The rent is a bit steep. It's pretty challenging to secure a house for lease.
The increase of prices on fruit that are good for us and food that we need is just, I think it's getting a bit out of control.
And these thrifty shoppers in the suburb of Highett in Melbourne's southeast are still feeling the hip pocket pinch.
Electricity and gas. They're the obvious ones.
Yeah, we've definitely cut back on some things, and I'm just a bit mindful about what I spend my money on these days a little bit more. Yeah, I'm actually have my own business, so I, you know, the ups and downs of the income doesn't really help with that, and I've definitely felt that people have stopped buying when the interest rates have gone up.
Definitely getting higher. And a good example is this hairdresser put their prices up from the beginning of the year, went from 15 to 20 to 25 all in like 1 year. So it was like, and it had been 15 for like a decade prior to that. And the other one that's very costly is medical stuff. Like if you need specialists or doctors, that they're not doing enough for that. Let's just say that they need to be subsidizing that more. I basically go out less often or I eat at cheaper places. So you just order less stuff, and I don't go out as much as I used to because it's too costly to do it three or four times a week, whereas now it's like maybe once every week or once a fortnight or something like that. So I don't have a mortgage myself because I'm locked out of the market, basically. So I have to stay with family for pretty much forever.
The Reserve Bank meets next Tuesday to make its first interest rate decision for 2024.
That report by David Taylor, Samantha Donovan and Isabel Massali. To discuss the cost of living and the government's tax cut changes, the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, joined me earlier. Treasurer, thanks for joining us here on PM. Is this good news for Australians, and how much credit should we give the government?
Well, thanks for having me back on your show, David. You know, this is really welcome and really encouraging news today, but we're not getting carried away with it because we know that Australians are still under pressure. And that's why our cost of living tax cut for middle Australia is so important. And one of the really encouraging things about the numbers that we saw today was that the ABS has made it really clear that the government's policies on cheaper early childhood education, our policy on electricity bill relief, and our policy on rent assistance, all of those things are putting downward pressure on inflation, in their estimation, taking something like half a percentage point of off inflation. And so that's encouraging too. So overall, very pleasing, very welcome, very encouraging, but it's not mission accomplished in this fight against inflation because people are doing it tough still. We understand that, we acknowledge that, and we're trying to do something about it with these tax cuts.
So when will this cost of living crisis end?
Well, we're closer to something that looks a bit more normal, you know, when it comes to inflation. But again, it's not mission accomplished. We're not getting carried away with it because we want inflation to moderate a bit further and a bit faster, frankly. We understand that. We're realistic about that. But we're talking about a pretty substantial moderation in inflation since its peaks in 2022. The numbers are encouraging, but we know that there's still a bit more work to do. We're providing this cost of living relief. We're providing these tax cuts in a way that doesn't put additional pressure on inflation. We're getting the budget in much better nick. All of those things are really about making sure we're doing everything we can to get on top of this inflation challenge in our economy.
So you say that the data is encouraging, we're closer to something that looks normal when it comes to inflation. Your tax relief for low and middle Australia won't actually start trickling out until July. The full cut when it comes to sort of annual relief won't be realised for another year after that. That's 18 months from now. Considering interest rates may have to actually be cut later in the year, isn't there a chance the cost of living crisis will be over by the time your tax relief changes are fully realised?
No, I think it will still be really important that we provide that cost of living relief via the tax system. It will start to flow from the middle of this year, which is really important. But the other point to make is that there is other cost of living help already flowing in the interim. And as we said a moment ago, whether it's electricity bill relief, cheaper early childhood education, rent assistance, but also cheaper medicines, also a range of other steps that we are taking. The tax cuts are a really important part of our cost of living relief plan, but they're not the only part of it. There's some relief already flowing right now. But what we're able to do with the tax cuts is make sure that everybody still gets a tax cut, every taxpayer gets a tax cut. But it's a bigger tax cut for more people to deal with these cost of living pressures. I don't think anybody anticipates that by the middle of the year, these cost of living pressures will have disappeared, but people will get a bit of additional help with the pressures that they're under.
But if the changes are really about cost of living, and that's the way you're selling them, that's the way you're justifying the broken promise, why not commit to changing the system back to how it was, what it was planned to be, when this cost of living crisis is over?
because the tax cuts that we're putting forward are not some kind of compromise. They are the best available set of changes which recognise that every taxpayer can get a tax cut, but we can put a bigger emphasis on middle Australia. And I think your question goes to a really important point. You know, too much of the commentary pretends, I think wrongly, that we have to choose between relief or reform, whereas what we're doing here is we're providing relief and reform. You know, our tax cuts provide more relief to middle Australia, but they also provide better reform for our economy. And we know that from the Treasury advice, which talks about the positive impact when it comes to labour supply and work incentives and all of these important objectives that we have in
our
economy.
But if it's about reform, I mean, that was around before the election. You could have been upfront with the Australian people before the election, couldn't you?
Well, it became increasingly clear to us as we were dealing with these persistent and sustained cost of living pressures that the tax cuts in 2024 could do a better job of matching the economic circumstances that we confront. Not 2 years ago, not 5 years ago when Scott Morrison first legislated these changes. And so I think we've been upfront with people, David. We've said that our position has changed. We own that. We take responsibility for that. And that's because we found a far more effective way to provide more relief for more people dealing with these cost of living pressures.
What are voters telling you about this broken promise? You've been out in Dunkley today ahead of a by-election in early March.
Well, I want to make it really clear, David, that these tax changes that we're putting forward are primarily, as you said in your earlier question, about cost of living, and they're also about the economy. And we're trying to put people and the economy before politics. We knew that the change in position would be contentious. But whether it's Dunkley or Dixon or Farrer or Ford, every taxpayer gets a tax cut. And in Dunkley, something like 87%, I think, of taxpayers will get a bigger tax cut as a consequence of our changes. You know, I met with Jodie Bellier in her community. She's a wonderful local candidate, and we stood in support of the early educators. And early educators, I think something like 97% of early educators will get a bigger tax cut. And so my message really to Peter Dutton and to the Liberals is don't stand in the way of a bigger tax cut for early childhood educators that we're with today, steelworkers in Northern Tasmania we were with yesterday with Brian Mitchell, my colleague. This is an opportunity to give people a bigger tax cut to help with the cost of living pressures. And that's not a. That's all about putting people before politics. Unfortunately, our opponents are putting politics before people.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it, David. All the best.
That's the Treasurer Jim Chalmers there. You're listening to PM. I'm David Lipson. Queensland's wet weather battle isn't over yet, with floodwater stretching across the state's northwest as devastated residents mop up in the southeast. Ex-tropical cyclone Kirrily is headed north, but due to swing south by the end of the week, potentially dumping more torrential rain on already flooded parts of the state. Stephanie Smale and Elizabeth Crampsey report.
The flash flooding that smashed through Samford has soaked some of Peter Hoffman's most treasured possessions. Her son Brandon died last year, and the things of his she's kept are now sodden.
All Brandon's photos and his childhood stuff, and it's all gone this time. We managed to save it from the last flood, but all that sort of stuff, you know, stuff that you can't get back.
Peter Hoffman's home is still being rebuilt after flood damage in 2022. Most of her family keepsakes were stored in a container on their property that's been flooded.
We've got it all laid out on planks and everything like that in the house, as you can see, to try and dry it out to save it as much as we can. And over here, the same thing, cards and stuff like that.
Now she's facing another cleanup.
I need to be home. I want to be home.
In Queensland's northwest, ex-tropical cyclone Kirrily isn't letting up. It's deluge cutting roads and isolating communities. In some parts, the muddy floodwaters stretch as far as the eye can see, with graziers who haven't already moved stock to higher ground doing it now. The swollen Diamantina River swamped the heritage-listed Blue Heeler Hotel at Kainuna.
As you can see, if you want a beer at the Blue Heeler, you better take your floaties with you.
It's put parts of David Batt's cattle property in the same region underwater too. Ex-tropical cyclone Kirrily is expected to do a U-turn and head south again by the end of the week, sending more water down rivers and creeks. But with his animals safely on higher ground, David Batt says he's not worried yet.
Oh, it's under my mailbox, which is about 2.5-3K from the first channel of the river, so it's got a pretty big spread on. Obviously, there's been a lot of rain up there. If we get that rain again in, you know, 10 days' time, it'll be huge then, truly huge.
As outback rivers rise, the mop-up continues north of Brisbane, where flash flooding ripped through homes. The Moreton Bay Mayor Peter Flannery says assessors are now working out who can access hardship payments.
This has a lot of debris around. There's a lot of mud and silt on hard surfaces. Council's just moving into the process now of hosing down these hard surfaces and trying to assess what the kind of damage is and what we can do to help them out.
And how long are you expecting this clean-up to take?
The clean-up itself, I think, will take a number of weeks. And then there's the rebuild of, people have got water through their properties, going to have tradesmen come in and replace walls and whatnot. Unfortunately, some of them have just been repaired from the 2022 damage and have been hit with damage again. So I really feel for those people.
With river and creek catchments already so wet in many parts of the state, authorities are watching the skies and river levels closely.
Stephanie Smale and Elizabeth Cramsey there. The Environmental Defenders Office is a legal centre dedicated to protecting the environment, but its future is under a cloud with the federal opposition vowing to cut its funding and accusing the body of legal warfare against industry. The EDO was recently criticised by a judge for submitting confected evidence in court, and the Albanese government put the organisation on notice, though stopped short of threatening its funding. Some legal experts, along with a state leader, argue cutting its funding would be a knee-jerk response that would undermine crucial environmental safeguards. Gavin Coote reports.
More than halfway into its term in opposition, the coalition is still hammering out its policy platform for the next federal election. Among its first promises, defunding the Environmental Defenders Office. Jonathan Dunningham is the Shadow Minister for the Environment.
Taxpayers' money is a finite resource, and we're better off ploughing that into health, education, infrastructure or cost of living measures.
The Environmental Defenders Office runs litigation and offers legal support on climate change and environment cases, and had its federal funding restored in 2022 after being cut by the Abbott government 9 years earlier. The organisation has faced criticism over its conduct in a federal court case, with Justice Natalie Charlesworth ruling it confected evidence and coached witnesses in its legal challenge of a Santos gas project in the Timor Sea. And while the Northern Territory Labor government is now reviewing its funding to the EDO, Jonathan Dunningham argues it's just one of a number of cases that have raised questions.
Well, it's a concern we've held for some time. And when the end goal is to terminate projects that we need for either energy security or other economic factors for our future, then we need to ensure that money is diverted into something else.
Of course, taxpayers' money goes into other legal services like the Community Legal Centre. So what's different about the EDO?
Well, I think that, you know, the Women's Legal Service, the Tenants Union, organisations like that that genuinely provide services to members of our community in need, that need legal assistance, is important. What we saw in the Santos case is nothing like that. Integrity is one thing, but trying to find reasons to unpick propositions that would see economic activity and jobs is not a good use of taxpayers' money.
The Albanese government has put the EDO on notice, with Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek saying she expects the organisation is taking the recent court judgment seriously. And while oil and gas industry body Australian Energy Producers supports the coalition's pledge to defund the body, the WA Premier Roger Cook has dismissed the idea.
The idea that you can defund the EDO is a knee-jerk political retail sort of response to the situation.
While others completely reject the idea that the EDO is causing economic harm.
Now, there's absolutely and utterly no evidence to support that.
Professor Andrew McIntosh is an environmental law and policy scholar with Australian National University who argues a well-funded EDO is vital.
In simple terms, what they're about is constraining governments and making sure that governments follow due process where they're issuing approvals to projects that cause environmental harms.
Are there some real questions that need to be answered, though, around its integrity?
I don't think there's any evidence other than this case of the EDO engaging in malpractice or inappropriate conduct, and certainly not that I know of. I'm not associated with the EDO, and I'm not a cheerleader for them, but I do see their work, and I haven't seen a lot of evidence, and this is really the only case that I know of where a judge has thrown the book at them and questioned their practices. Every organisation has instances where people behave inappropriately, and as a consequence, I'm not saying that these people, anyone's behaved inappropriately here, but if they have, then there are processes for dealing with that, and defunding the EDO and seeking to discredit the EDO is not the way to deal with that issue.
The Environmental Defenders Office has expressed disappointment at the Coalition's pledge to defund it. In a statement, CEO David Morris says its lawyers have served people and communities across Australia for nearly 40 years and provide a vital service.
Gavin Coote there. Israeli forces appear to have stepped up their attacks on Hamas in Jenin. Israeli soldiers disguised as doctors and civilians have killed suspected Hamas operatives who were being treated in a hospital in the occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, UN Watch, an organisation which monitors the UN, has warned Australia not to reinstate funding for the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA. Rachel Mealy reports.
Disguised as doctors and patients, Israeli forces entered the Ibn Sina Hospital in the West Bank town of Jenin and shot three men. The Palestinian Health Ministry described the raid as a war crime, but US State Department spokesman Matthew Miller defended Israel's right to bring terrorists to justice.
Israel has said that these were Hamas operatives. They have said that one of them was carrying a gun at the time of the operation, so I'm not able to speak to the facts of the operation. You'd have to pass some kind of legal judgment, know all of the facts of the operation. But as a general matter, they do have the right to carry out operations to bring terrorists to justice, but they need to be conducted
including in a hospital.
So we want them to conduct their operations in compliance with their national humanitarian law.
Away from the conflict, the US Congress has begun hearings investigating allegations against the UN Relief and Works Agency known as UNRWA. Australia has joined 10 other nations in pausing funding to the agency after allegations suggesting several of UNRWA's employees were involved in Hamas's October 7th attacks in Israel. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has described the allegations as credible.
We haven't had the ability to investigate them ourselves, but they are highly, highly credible.
But at the same time, Secretary Blinken acknowledges the important humanitarian work that UNRWA is doing in Gaza.
UNRWA has played and continues to play an absolutely indispensable role in trying to make sure that men, women and children who so desperately need assistance in Gaza actually get it. And no one else can play the role that UNRWA has been playing, certainly not in the near term. No one has the reach, the capacity, the structure to do what UNRWA has been doing. And from our perspective, it's imperative that role continues.
UNRWA has sacked the accused workers and is conducting its own investigation into the allegations. Hillel Noya is the executive director of UN Watch, a pro-Israel non-government organisation which monitors the UN. He gave evidence in front of Congress today and told PM that the Hamas infiltration of the agency is more extensive than people think.
It's a complete lie that it's a few bad apples. This is systematic at UNRWA.
He says his organisation, UN Watch, has documented its concerns over many years, but they've been ignored by the UN and by the US State Department. And he's urging the Australian government not to resume funding to the agency.
What I'm asking Australia is not to just let this blow over, because I saw the statement of your foreign minister, which was, if I'm going to paraphrase it, it was UNRWA's doing a great job. UNRWA's going to investigate. They responded quickly and beautifully, and were the suspending the funds was sort of put as a small little detail, and we have full faith and confidence in them. For 9 years, we've sent them evidence of UNRWA involvement with terrorism. There has been zero intention from them to investigate and take it seriously. The notion that they're going to investigate themselves, this is not an independent investigation that's going on now. These are internal UN investigations where they all protect themselves.
UNRWA has warned that without funding, it won't be able to carry on beyond February. But Hillel Noya says UN Watch would rather see the complete collapse of the aid agency than have it continue with Hamas employees in its ranks.
When there's a crisis in Syria or Sudan, the international community doesn't have an agency on the ground. They send in good agencies like UNHCR, World Food Programme. They have a cluster, a humanitarian cluster managed by OCHA, the UN Humanitarian Agency, and they know how to deliver aid. We are not trapped in a situation that we must use an agency that is dominated by Hamas.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says he's horrified by the accusations, but has urged donor nations to reinstate funding. UNRWA says any employee who was involved in acts of terror will be held accountable, including through criminal prosecution.
Rachel Mealy there. Well, back home, Muslim doctors here in Australia say they're being unfairly reported to the health regulator for criticising Israel's military operations in Gaza on social media. Some doctors have been reported to the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency, or APRA, accused of inciting anti-Semitism. But the doctors say all they're doing is calling for peace. Here's David Sparks.
Nicole is a trainee doctor in Queensland, and we're not using her real name here. Right now, she feels her career is under threat because she's been reported to APRA for a Facebook post relating to the war in Gaza. She's under review, and she says the stress is building. To protect her identity, we've got someone else voicing her comments.
I'm half Palestinian. My mum's family is Palestinian. I think that adding an APRA complaint to the distress that my family and I are going through, it's really quite horrible.
Nicole insists there was nothing anti-Semitic or pro-Hamas about her Facebook post.
So I shared a post in this private group and I was highlighting the ways in which doctors can be held responsible for posts on social media. Unfortunately, I was reported for this by an anonymous complainant stating or implying that I was trying to help people facilitate offensive discussions on social media.
What do you think motivated the person to report you? What's their thinking?
Yeah, so I mean, my gut feeling about all of this and certainly seeing the pattern of reports is that the primary goal is to silence us, to create fear amongst us, to stop posting about Palestine and to stop raising awareness about the humanitarian crisis there.
APRA says it's received notifications about 39 medical practitioners relating to social media posts on the war in Gaza. The agency has the power to investigate and in extreme cases ban doctors from practicing. PM has spoken to other Muslim doctors who are worried about reports made to APRA for comments in a private Facebook group for doctors who are mothers. One Muslim doctor who posted a message in support of Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, was accused of being pro-Hamas. Other doctors who criticised Israel's policies leading up to the October 7 attack or its tactics afterwards were accused of justifying the Hamas attacks. Marie Bismarck is a professor of law and health at the University of Melbourne and an expert on the APRA complaints process. When it comes to posts on social media, she says there are guidelines.
Most of it's really focused on the trust that patients need to have in that individual doctor and also in the wider professions. It has some pretty common sense recommendations like don't be posting confidential patient information online.
We're talking about comments in a fairly heated debate about a war. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you would usually expect APRA to be taking steps over?
It's important to keep in mind that all sorts of patients will be seeking healthcare in Australia. Some of them may be refugees. Many of them will come from different cultural and social and religious backgrounds. And it's important that all patients feel that they will be treated with respect and can safely seek healthcare. It's a really difficult balance because on the one hand, doctors do have a really important role in advocating for human rights. Personally, I have made comments in the past about the human rights of refugees who are seeking to come to Australia. And at the same time, you want to be careful that any comments you make online are not going to undermine trust in you as an individual doctor or in the healthcare system more widely.
PM does not know who reported the doctors featured in this story. Zionist Federation of Australia President Jeremy Liebler provided a statement saying after the October 7 Hamas attacks, some doctors began using social media in ways that were both inconsistent with their role as healers and incendiary to their Jewish patients. APRA says of the 39 medical practitioners reported, about a third have been informed of the outcome or will be informed in coming days. Reviews are ongoing for the others.
David Sparks there. That's the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. See you tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When masked men clad in black tried to demonstrate in Sydney on Australia Day, police were quick to use the powers they have to get rid of them. They were neo-Nazis from across the country. So apart from making a scene, what do these men want and what are they capable of? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.